This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The clock's ticking down for Massachusetts General Hospital and its employees. Tomorrow is the deadline to get vaccinated for the hospital's nearly 28,000 workers. As of October 6th, in the entire Mass General Brigham system, about 4,000 employees had failed to meet the mandate. So what's going to happen tomorrow and to how many people at Mass General? We had a chance to ask the new president of MGH, Dr. David Brown, just a couple of hours ago about all of this. He has been on the job for just about a month now. Dr. Brown tells us his goal is to make sure everyone keeps their jobs and gets vaccinated.
Across Mass General Brigham, we have about 77,000 employees. And as of this morning, we still had about 2,200 who were either unvaccinated or whose status is still unknown. And at Mass General, where we have 28,000 employees, we have about 800 or so people still unvaccinated this morning. About half of those are per diem staff who aren't here very frequently, and the other half, about 400 or so, are regular employees.
And what happens with those regular employees beginning tomorrow, Dr. Brown? Are they placed on unpaid leave like the city of Boston just did for over 800 employees earlier this week? Are they fired? How does that work?
Well, first, we hope that that number is going to be a lot smaller by tomorrow. We're busy confirming among that group of 800 at Mass General who among that group is in fact vaccinated and can provide confirmation of that. We're also providing first dose vaccinations across our system to about 800 people a day. And that's very encouraging as our deadline looms.
So excuse me for interrupting, but you're doing that internally. So if you have an employee in the hospital who's not yet vaccinated, they can get that shot right in the hospital.
That's correct. Across our system at a variety of locations. Yes.
Dr. Brown, do you know the job breakdown? Do you have eyes in, and is that something that you can share with us? Is there a particular type of employee in the hospital more likely to be unvaccinated?
Well, it's spread across all role groups, really, at every level of the organization. We have unvaccinated physicians, very few, but some. We have some unvaccinated nurses. There isn't one role group that seems to be disproportionately impacted based on the denominator of employees in that role group. Anyone who is fully vaccinated or has had the first vaccination by tomorrow and has a second vaccination planned will meet our requirement for vaccination. And of course, we will follow up on those who still have a second vaccine to undergo. And then we will spend time over the weekend adjudicating our final list, and anyone who remains on it next week will be suspended next week, and we will have to move towards termination there.
Will they have the option of potentially getting a first dose at one of these locations you've talked about and staving off a permanent firing?
Absolutely. It is our goal to fire no one. It is our goal to protect all of our employees with vaccination as we protect all of our patients by vaccinating our staff.
So the last question I have on this, Dr. Brown, you know, you were the head of MGH's emergency department throughout the pandemic. You were quite reflective in the early days and talked about just the strain of that. And I wonder, given what you've seen about what this disease can do, does it frustrate you to have employees who are not yet vaccinated? And how are you talking to them about that to encourage them to get the shots?
It doesn't frustrate me, but it concerns me because we're a healthcare organization and our responsibility is to provide a safe and welcoming environment to our patients, many of whom aren't yet eligible for vaccination. That would be children under 12. And many of whom, due to their underlying illnesses, aren't able to mount a protective immune response to the vaccine. So our first responsibility is to our patients and to provide a safe environment in which they can receive care. And that's why we set this requirement of vaccination for all of our employees. We've worked really hard to try to get the information that our employees need as they consider vaccination, and we're continuing to do that today. We'll continue to do it all day tomorrow. We'll do it next week if anyone wants to talk to us who remains unvaccinated. We've tried to meet people where they are, understand what their concerns are, and then try to help them work their way through those concerns and ultimately get vaccinated.
And what about boosters? Where will they fit in this picture? Is there a time when you'll expect employees or mandate that employees receive appropriate boosters as well?
That's a good question for which the answer remains unknown. Booster shots are now recommended for a number of people, including those whose occupation places them in contact with patients with COVID and therefore puts them at some increased risk. And healthcare workers fall into that last category. And so we're offering and encouraging our staff to get boosters. So we're recommending that, but we don't have a policy yet around the requirement for boosters.
So let's just step back for a little bit. You again, were head of emergency during this pandemic. You have walked through the halls of Mass General Hospital, I would assume, at some of its most chaotic moments. When you walk through the halls of the hospital today, what does it look like and what does it feel like?
Well, we're in a very different place. During the first surge, which was about 20 months ago, in addition to being really overwhelmed by the influx of very sick patients, patients with COVID-related pneumonia, in respiratory failure, patients requiring immediate treatment, often intensive care level treatment. Not only was there an enormous volume of patients coming in, we didn't have any certainty about where it would end, and we didn't have any certainty that the protective equipment we were wearing would actually work. At one point at Mass General, we had 490 of our beds filled with COVID-positive patients at the peak of the first surge. That's a pretty stunning number in a 1,000-bed hospital to have almost half of its beds filled with patients with a single disease. Now we have about 45 patients in the hospital with COVID, and it's not impacting in an overwhelming way our daily operations like it did during that first surge. And in addition, now we have learned that our protective equipment does in fact work. And so the fear factor is really behind us. What I feel now and what I'm worried about most now is the sort of the long-term effects of responding to the pandemic among healthcare workers, because it's not just the impact of the pandemic at work, it's the impact of the pandemic at home. And it's created a lot of stress and anxiety for our workforce. And I'm most worried about the impact of that today and in the future.
So what do you do for them?
That's a really good question. So we try to provide support. Of course, we provide vaccination. And we try to listen to what people are worried about, what people are thinking about, and try to respond to those things. There were staff shortages across healthcare before the pandemic. And the pandemic has made that worse as people in healthcare have reevaluated what they want out of their work life and what they want in terms of balance between work and the rest of their lives. And some of those people have not come back to full-time or as much part-time work as they did pre-pandemic. And that's exacerbated staffing challenges and made caring for patients, not just with COVID, but with all sorts of diseases and injuries more difficult.
You know this hospital intimately. You started at MGH back in 1989, and now you are running, you know, an organization with 28,000 employees. It's a multi-billion-dollar organization. You're speaking very matter-of-factly here with me about issues that are existential for the hospital, for the industry, for the health of our country. Early in the pandemic, you were known for being reflective, for sending out emails that acknowledged what people were feeling, texting people to check in on them in the middle of the night. How do you strike the balance between the clear-eyed professional who's running a, you know, multi-billion-dollar institution and the compassionate caregiver who needs to be responsive to patients and staff?
Well, I think that's a challenge that all of us in healthcare face, not just me. I try to think about the big picture. I try to think about the mission of the hospital. You know, our founder said, when in distress, every person becomes our neighbor. And I've thought many times during the pandemic that never in Mass General's 211-year history now has that been more true.
So you talked about the mission of the hospital. And missions are important, but they change. When catastrophic things happen in the world, changes around us. You're a new president. What's the mission now, and what are your goals? What do you have to get done in the next 6 months, in the next 12 months?
Well, I think some of it's what we already talked about. We have to continue to respond to the pandemic. In addition, we have to provide the care that was delayed during the pandemic that is necessary to keep, you know, our patients and our communities healthy. And we have to take care of our staff, who, as I mentioned, have borne the burden of the pandemic in extraordinary ways and are feeling those effects. So that's priority number one for me. And then continuing to focus on the other aspects of our mission, continuing to train the next generation of leaders in the House of Medicine, continuing to invest in the science and the innovation that will change the way we deliver healthcare in the future and how we will treat disease in the future, and then continuing to engage with and serve our communities who rely on us, and to do so through the lens of health equity.
I do want to stay with health equity for a minute. So you've got this $1.9 billion expansion in the city, two towers in the area around Cambridge Street. It'll create net 94 new beds, as I understand it, with what sounds like an emphasis on private beds. You've said that you want to move sort of specialty healthcare into the MGH buildings to do what you do best. Where does that put the low income, the uninsured health needs of the people surrounding the hospital and those whose vulnerabilities in our current public health system have been so laid bare by this pandemic?
I'll just start with the G in MGH stands for general, and we're a general hospital for the communities right around our building that we serve. They consider us their local community hospital, and we're proud to provide their general medical care, and that'll always be part of our mission. Now, I chose emergency medicine as my own specialty for the privilege, really the honor, of being invited into a patient's life on their worst day. And whether they're in the ED for a sprained ankle or they've been in a terrible car accident or anything in between, it's really their worst day. I mean, no one wakes up in the morning and says, I think I'll come to the emergency department today. And so being invited into that moment and trying to make it better, trying to relieve suffering, reduce pain, improve quality of life, treat disease, there's something very incredibly special about that for me, and it's why I chose emergency medicine and why I went into medicine to begin with. And that's always been core to the mission here at MGH. And I wanted to do that for my whole community without regard to whether or not a person could pay or the color of their skin, who they worshiped, who they loved. So back to your question, we do need to build this new building in order to ensure that we can deliver the care that our patients will need into the future, into this century. We're delivering care in really antiquated buildings now. We are a 1,000-bed hospital, but 62% of our beds are double occupancy. You can't build a hospital now with double occupancy rooms. It's simply not allowed, and yet almost two-thirds of our beds are double occupancy. I don't want to share a hotel room with somebody I don't know when I'm healthy, and I certainly don't want to share a room with someone I don't know when I'm not healthy, and our patients deserve single rooms. You know, our patients are already here, and we're not taking the kind of care of them that I'd like to. We started this morning with about 60 patients in the emergency department waiting for beds to open upstairs, and that's a high number, but it's not an off-the-charts number. We start the day with double-digit patients waiting for inpatient beds every single morning, and so we need to move to a hospital of the future with single rooms that allow us to harness innovation, that allow us to respond to infection control issues, and that allow us to take care of the patients that we're already caring for, but in a suboptimal way due to our insufficient physical plan.
Last question for you, Dr. Brown. There is a sort of public health authority, a particular one, to your role as the head of a world-renowned teaching hospital. We are still in the pandemic. According to data from the Kaiser Family Foundation, approximately 90,000 people died from COVID in the country between June and September who maybe didn't have to had they been vaccinated. What is your message to the public right now?
Yeah, well, that's a heartbreaking statistic. The patients who have died of COVID since the widespread availability of vaccine, most of those deaths are unnecessary. And as a physician, as a public health official, as I said, that's a heartbreaking number for me. My message is that vaccinations are safe, they're effective, they prevent serious illness, they prevent hospitalization, they prevent death, and the alternative really is to get COVID. So the decision isn't, should I get vaccinated or not? The decision is, should I get vaccinated or I will get COVID? Because the variants we have now are extremely transmissible, and they're not going to go away. So for the unvaccinated among us, the alternative is to get COVID. And the dangers associated with that are completely unnecessary in an era of safe and widely available effective vaccines.
That is Dr. David Brown, president of Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Brown, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We have been following the Boston mayoral race closely together on this show, and you've heard us delve into a range of pretty serious issues, from the humanitarian crisis at the intersection of Massachusetts Avenue and Melnia Cass Boulevard to police reform. New poll numbers out today from WBUR, the Dorchester Reporter, the Boston Foundation, and the Mass Inc. polling group show that Boston voters also care a whole lot about schools, how they're run, how they're supporting kids in this, the third academic year affected by the pandemic. WBUR education reporter Max Larkin joins us now to tell us more about what we learned. Max, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So Max, dive us right in. Walk us through the main findings.
Yeah, as we reported yesterday, and as you said, the poll shows, you know, education's top of mind for all kinds of voters in Boston this fall. Even voters over 60 or voters without kids in the district want improving schools to be a top priority for the next leaders to take over. And they also want to participate in the change, Tiziana. This is now maybe the second or third poll that has found widespread support for a return to an elected school committee in Boston. We've gone almost 30 years without, as you may recall. But the question is going to be on city ballots in just a few weeks. And then finally, you had a narrow majority saying they see the task ahead as kind of twofold. Yes, schools have to help kids catch up academically, but the majority feels they also have to help those kids who were isolated at home, maybe feeling the effects of lost work or relatives getting sick. They have to help them recover personally, emotionally, and socially.
Those are pretty clear marching orders, Max. Did anything surprise you in these findings?
Yeah, I think the surprising outcome for me is that near consensus about moving to an elected committee. Granted, it's, you know, 60-something percent of the vote. There are still a lot of voters undecided on the matter, but it would be a big change. And if the poll were held today, or the ballot question, it seems like that question would pass, and maybe even easily.
So lots of ways that these numbers were sliced and diced, right? Very thorough demographic breakdowns, not just age, gender, race, also income levels, neighborhood, whether a person owns or rents a home, if they have kids in school, even how they voted in the preliminary election for mayor. So did we see differences in attitudes across the different groups?
Yeah, as you note, Tiziana, you know, the crosstabs are always fascinating.
Love
where the different
stuff.
Groups are sort of broken down. But the surprise here was the consistency across all of these different groups, whether or not you like or don't like Governor Baker, whether you're voting for Michelle Wu or Anissa Asabi George, the song was pretty much the same. You had a, you know, big majority saying schools need help. They have their work cut out for them as they try to help kids recover. And, you know, we may want to look in terms of a chance to choose our school committee members.
All right. So to review, three big questions. How important are schools? Do you want an elected school committee? What's the focus of helping kids? Let's break them down a little bit more. Where do you think this overwhelming support for improving schools overall comes from? I noted you said even if you're over 60, even if you don't have kids, you want this.
Yeah, I think some of it's really earned. Any of us who are parents know it's not easy to see your kid in a mask. It's not easy to send your kid off to an environment that you don't know whether or not it's safe. And you know that there's kind of this sort of penumbra of anxiety around it in any event. And that's maybe showing up in this information and in some of the interviews we've done since the results were released. But then I think we've also heard and ourselves broadcast a lot on the academic and personal losses that kids have suffered. And there, you know, there is a sense of, I don't want to say panic because that seems sort of dismissive, but there seems to be an ambient anxiety that perhaps kids got the worst of the pandemic, even though they were hospitalized in far more limited numbers than much older people.
So I want to, too, Max, go back because you said the biggest surprise to you was this support for an elected school committee. I don't know what numbers I was expecting, but the numbers did surprise me, too. What do you think's going on there? Now, and you also, I want to remember, you noted this isn't the first time we've seen this in a poll.
Yeah, I think the appointed committee has its virtues, right? That you can have people who might be academics, lawyers, community leaders, and might not have the time or inclination to run, a straightforward political campaign. But I do think that lots of people, you know, note that Boston is the only municipal district in the state that does it this way. And some of them are like, well, why don't I get to vote for this too? Rosani Sanabria is an East Boston resident and a BPS graduate. And for her, it's just common sense. You get the parent voice in the form of the vote, and that makes for an organic connection to the people who are running the district.
I still would like them to have the kind of the basic requirements that anybody in that position should have, that they could theoretically still get the job done. But I think it's important that the parents have a little bit more of a personal say and they have a vote for it. That way we keep them accountable.
Tiziana, I looked at the vote 30 years ago that made this change. It was narrow, very, very narrow. And so there does seem to just be a reflex. You know, we like voting. We like a chance to choose who represents us. Why? Maybe as simple as that in some ways.
So speaking of surprises, Max, I guess I expected that people would come down heavily on either schools need to focus on catching up academically or schools need to help kids socially, emotionally. But a slim majority said it's got to be both. So what have you heard from parents on this?
Yeah, that's true. On balance, it feels like parents, maybe myself or yourself included, we're asking a lot of schools, you have to be both the instructor, the catch-up agent, and the sort of caretaker. And yet we've sort of always asked that. That being said, Tiziana, there was a healthy minority that wants schools to just focus on the academic piece. Sean Barrett of South Boston spoke for that group, saying, in effect, parents know how to handle the more intangible parts of their kids' recovery.
If the kids are going to school and working on academics and doing what they're supposed to do, I think that other things will fall in line. My son is having some mental health issues himself, but I think the place to address that is with their physicians in the appropriate setting.
And yet, I think it's worth also hearing an educator's view here, Tiziana. Paula Cantor is a BPS parent. She lives in Mattapan, but she also teaches in the Randolph Public Schools, which was relatively hard hit in some ways. And so she says she's sort of seeing up close what a turbulent experience this past year or 18 months have been for middle school age kids, and that those kids, you know, have felt an impact and yet may not themselves know that they need a little support to getting back to normal.
Yeah, it's intense. And I don't think the kids even necessarily realize how intense it's really been. Like, they know it probably in their mind, but they don't really know how to process it or talk about it. Sometimes, especially middle school kids, they don't want to talk about it because they're just kind of like, I'm done with it. It's over, blah, blah, blah. But I do think it has to be processed.
There's this sense, you know, of an invisible toll. And anyone who has contact with kids, you know, and maybe has seen a spectrum of different kids' reactions to the pandemic, you know, realizes that there's some healing to be done there, too.
So, you know, as I noticed, Max, the unified importance of schools to people who voted for both of the now final candidates for mayor. I was thinking about the WBZ televised debate last night. I was watching it, and the moderator, John Keller, was really pushing Wu and Asaibe George to differentiate themselves, to point out the differences, saying their positions seem pretty similar. And that was striking given the similar support across their supporters for schools. Are there any fault lines for the voters here at all?
Yeah, I think perhaps we are suffering from having, you know, asked pretty general questions as a way of taking the temperature, when I know and you know that the devil's in the details with a lot of these issues having to do with one's children and the way the society and education are structured. You know, things flare up and parents get easily polarized around them. I spoke to Dan Barkin, who lives in Roslindale, and he was one of the few who explicitly opposed this idea of moving back to an elected school committee, in part because of that concern. Let's hear that.
I would just be worried that the school committee, in a weird way, would no longer reflect what the city of Boston wants and aspires to, because turnout could be really low. And the issues are sort of asymmetrical in how much they fire folks up.
I think Barkin raised interesting points, Tiziana, saying, you know, think about critical race theory or mask mandates. These are things that have become kind of screaming matches that we wouldn't necessarily have anticipated even 12 or 18 months ago. I also note that lots of Asian parents came out against this move made in the last few months to reduce the importance of standardized testing in exam school admissions. Now, per this poll, that community overwhelmingly favors a move to an elected school committee. But, you know, they may want and expect that committee to do very different things from some of their neighbors. And so there is, you know, maybe some ambivalence or disagreement hiding in the apparent consensus.
So schools are important, but the devil, as you said, is in the details, Max.
It has to be a concrete issue. And then once that emerges, you get to really have the debate.
All right, so let's zoom out. Boston is set to receive $400 million in federal pandemic money. What do we know about plans for that money? And I'm curious, and whether you know, are those plans reflective of the priorities that we heard from voters in this poll?
I think so. The district has tried to do a drawn-out sort of public-facing process about the so-called ESSER funds, the federal relief for schools. The district just applied earlier this month for the last and largest part of that federal relief. I think it's $270 million or so. And they're going to try to spread that money around. So there's $20 million for facilities, $37 million for staffing to help with students with disabilities and English learners, and then athletics, nurses, guidance counselors. There is a hope that I'm sure that this can be a sort of transformative investment in the district, but it is a diverse district, and it may be that some of the goals that individual families have might not be met. The hope is just that you reach almost everyone by distributing it around.
So lastly, Max, you know, we did this poll in the context of a mayoral race, elections in 2.5 weeks. What are you watching for between now and then?
I would say historically, these two candidates that we're looking at have had different philosophies, differences of opinion with regard to how the school district should be run. Should there be more investment or more sort of accountability type measures? As I think I mentioned, Asabi George opposed the elected committee when we asked her about it. I'm really hoping that in more debate, more interviews, that little bit of daylight can emerge so that parents who are preoccupied with education will get to make more of an informed kind of discrete selection. We'll have to see.
All right. Max Larkin, WBUR education reporter. We will follow along with you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Nothing but a man. Now, maybe a little girl in Shrewsbury uttered those words, and maybe she didn't. But historically, it seems clear, at least, that some people were thinking it some 230 years ago as they lined the streets, elbow to elbow, to see the nation's first president, George Washington, as he made his way across Massachusetts. The question was, as the new president journeyed across the original 13 states in an effort to unify them, would enough of those skeptics, having seen that nothing but a man, find him sufficiently larger than life to help hold our young country together? And that question is what makes our next guest's book so interesting. Nathaniel Philbrick, author and historian, has read and written a lot about the American Revolution, but his newest work, Travels with George in Search of Washington and His Legacy, is a different look at the historical giant. And he joins us now to tell us about it. Nathaniel Philbrick, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's great to be with you.
It's great to have you. So I did not think of George Washington, excuse me just a sec, I didn't think of him in New England. I think of him in Delaware, right in the South. But he wanted to see all of 13 of what had been the colonies to unify them, didn't he? And so why bring that trip alive, and why take the trip yourself as part of that journey?
Yeah, well, you know, we're living in times of what have been called repeatedly unprecedented political division. And I thought, well, what would it be like to follow George Washington's travels across the original 13 states when he was trying to unify this country? What if I followed him today in this time of division? Would I get what kind of historical perspective I would get by following the guy as he was trying to unify this country at the very beginning of our history? And so my wife and I and our dog Dora, doing our kind of John Steinbeck imitation, followed Washington, and on several tours to New England, the Middle Atlantic, and the South, as he was trying to create a sense of nationhood among 13 essentially independent states.
And following that same journey, what did you learn about where we are in our nationhood today?
In one sense, I found a lot hasn't changed. Washington and trying to unify the nation. It didn't mean that Washington did not experience the kind of partisanship we know today. When he was elected president, two states, Rhode Island and North Carolina, had not yet ratified the Constitution. The Constitution had deeply divided the country into those who believed in the strong national government it created and those who distrusted that strong federal government and believed the states should retain the power they had under the original Articles of Confederation. So Washington heads out and to unify the country and actually succeeds in that. But even by the end of his first term as president, his own Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson, is working to organize the political resistance. And that partisanship would expand to levels that even outdo where we are today by the end of Washington's second term. But even though Washington couldn't stop partisanship, even Washington, he had created something built to last. He had created a sense of nationhood that could survive those political differences of opinion.
So I'm going to do something we usually do a little later in a book conversation, which is have you read something. But I want to do it right now because I want to bring this home to Massachusetts. This was really striking to me. President Washington travels to Massachusetts. There's this argument about who should greet the president as he makes his way into Boston. And it leads, so you got Washington sitting on horseback in the middle of the street as dignitaries from Boston and the governor's office fight over who has jurisdiction to welcome the president of the United States into the city. Can you read that?
Yeah, sure. The newspaper editor, Benjamin Russell, who as a 13-year-old boy had watched the Battle of Bunker Hill from high ground nearby, was a member of one of the committees. Both authorities remained in their carriages while the aides and marshals were rapidly posting between them, Russell remembered. The president and his secretary had been mounted for a considerable time on the neck, waiting to enter the town. Washington asked what the matter was. When informed of the contretemps, he expressed impatience. Then he asked his secretary, William Jackson, is there no other avenue to the town? By that time, Washington had begun to turn his horse around and start back to Roxbury. This seems to have persuaded the contending parties to settle the dispute. Washington was informed that the controversy was over and that he would be received by the municipal authorities. The selectmen and Washington had won.
It's hilarious. When you really think about it, it's hilarious.
Absolutely, and you know this. What he was encountering were turf wars, not only you know in the state, but between the state and the city. You know, once again, some things have never changed. And you know what made this different was the governor was John Hancock, who was you know the biggest dude in Massachusetts. Until, of course, George Washington shows up. And Hancock had invited Washington to stay at his home, his big mansion on Beacon Hill, where the State House now is. And Washington had said, no, I can't do that because I can't play favorites during this tour. I must stay only in public taverns. Hancock didn't like that and didn't show up to the ceremonies welcoming Washington to Boston. Washington then informs Hancock, well, I'm not coming to your dinner party tonight unless you come see me first. And Hancock realized he had made a gross miscalculation and comes and pays tribute to George and making unmistakably clear that under this new form of government, a president outranks a governor, something that seems absurdly obvious today, but only because Washington did not accept John Hancock's dinner invitation.
So we're talking to Nathaniel Philbrick, historian and author of Travels with George in Search of Washington and His Legacy. And I want to stay on that. I'm glad you raised the Hancock dinner issue, because it was really striking to me that we were, in fact, sorting out for the first time, frankly, how important the president was going to be. And that John Hancock, who, you know, those who enjoy local history and certainly recognize the size of his signature, know that he fancied himself to be pretty important, too. And it was, in fact, his ego that set in relief and essentially wound up forcing us to establish in some important way this federalist approach to the president, just at a time when, as you say, there were some pretty serious fights going on about how important the states were versus the federal government.
Yeah, and, you know, you might have thought, well, Massachusetts would have been thoroughly behind the president. And, you know, in theory, yes, but the practicality of having this new person show up who is dressed in his general's uniform, by the way, as he rode down what was already called Washington Street into Boston, you know, creates this phenomenon of people just going crazy as he comes into town. And, you know, this is creating that sense of the wow factor that, you know, we all see today in political rallies with music playing and jumbotrons and all that. Well, Washington kind of invented the concept with his theatrical entrance into towns and cities dressed as the revolutionary hero he had been. And yet, on the other side, he's trying to be one of the people, staying in public taverns. It's a tricky dance he's playing, and a tricky dance presidents still play. How do you lead a group of people claiming to be one of them yourselves?
So let's stay in Massachusetts a little bit longer, and then we'll step back and we'll pick up some of these bigger themes. You know, you know the area. You live in Nantucket. And in a minute, we'll talk about what you learned about the places he went that weren't around here. But I wonder, in traveling the portion of Washington's trip that was here in Massachusetts and here in New England, did you rediscover, did the sort of the scales of today fall from your eyes, and did you rediscover corners of history in our own region that weren't obvious to you until you were sort of looking at them through this lens? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And it was happening every day we were following Washington. Well, you know, we were not taking highways. We were following those old historic roads that he would have used. And yes, they weren't the terrible dirt roads that they were in Washington's time. But what was really amazing to both my wife and I is, you know, we thought we knew Massachusetts pretty well. And this was particularly true north of Boston, as we're going from Boston through Marblehead to Salem and eventually into New Hampshire. You know, I knew those towns. I had visited them all. But usually I was driving the highway, taking an exit, and sort of parachuting into the town. We were following the old, you know, whether it was Route 1 or 1A, and inevitably that would become the town's main street. And so you began to feel that these towns were organically connected in a way that's not obvious today. If you're using, you know, the modes of transportation we tend to use today, whether it's a train or a highway. And so for me, this was a way to travel back in time. One of the frustrating things was, if you had Google on or something like that, it was always trying to get you on the highway. This was great. This is saying, no, you stay on those roads. They may be chock-a-block full of traffic, but you are following the original road that connected these towns and villages together as a cohesive unit.
And what's one place, one little building or corner here in New England that you either discovered or rediscovered when you were following in George Washington's footsteps that you can still kind of smell and see and connect with even now?
Well, you know, one of them, there's two. The one is the old State House in Boston. I mean, you know, you see it, it looks like an old building, but going into it, knowing that George Washington had, they had built a temporary sort of welcome center for Washington on one end of the building where a parade with 50 different guilds marched past. And to think of the scale of the city then, and now you've got all these, you're in the cavern of tall buildings, but with the scale of that State House, which was then one of the biggest buildings in the city there, it was amazing. It just was like a time vortex. And then there was a time when we're in Newburyport. My brother used to live in Newburyport. I thought we knew Newburyport. Well, Washington stayed in a large brick building in Newburyport that is now the town's public library. And so I visited the public library, and you know, this is where Washington stayed, in the periodical section. You know, it's just the sense of what has always been there has this untapped element of history that is there just for the looking. And so I thank George Washington to this day for for reacquainting him with the state that I call home.
So I have to say, after reading that, I did find myself thinking, I will always look at the periodicals section of my library differently after that. So let's step back a little bit. Let's step outside of New England and talk about his journey across what was then, right, the country. Because it was really striking that he was looking at a nation in the dust and rubble of a revolutionary victory. It was a triumphant nation and a devastated landscape. And I want you to talk about that a little bit and what it was like to sort of superimpose that post-revolutionary rubble of that time over the incredibly developed, as you say, highways everywhere, you know, built up everywhere, entire species of pine trees, the long pine, that were indigenous to the area, just gone. What was right. that like?
Yeah, and then this was particularly striking in the South, where, as you mentioned, the longleaf pine. You know, these trees were everywhere in the South, from North Carolina down to Florida, all the way west to Texas. These forests of long, straight, trunked trees with their leaves up very high, and created this kind of magical terrain. And they're gone. I mean, most of us have never seen a longleaf pine. Now they're loblolly pines, which are a very different kind of tree. And there are some new longleaf pine forests coming in North Carolina that we visited, and you get a sense of that. But then you get into Charleston and Savannah and inland and Camden, South Carolina. This is where in the final years of the Revolution, the war was fought, and there was devastation everywhere. And when Washington visited, he had been the commander in chief of the Continental Army, but he had been trapped up in around New York on the Hudson River, and so he had been directing the war remotely when it came to the South. And this journey to the South, and the Southern tour alone took him 3 months. He covered almost 2,000 miles, and he visited many of these old battlefields. And for him, as a former general, it was a truly, amazing experience in which the overlays of time were, you know, the devastation was still there in many instances. In fact, in Camden, North Carolina, the skeletons of the horses were still there from the Battle of Camden, fought in 1781. And so, you know, he had a better understanding, I think, than anyone in the United States at this point, that America's freedom had come at a cost.
You know, I'm thinking about all the different times that your choice to follow the same route Washington had led to metaphors, right? And we've talked about a couple of those. Another that strikes me is you and your wife basically almost got sucked up into a tornado in your
right.
boat off the coast of Nantucket, which just the whirlwind of our political divide sort of seemed to be sucking your boat up into it, you know, in
yeah.
that metaphor. I wonder, of course, COVID happened, right, while you were trying to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder now, are there metaphors from what we're experiencing in this pandemic that tie back to what Washington was seeing then and how that has resonated with you as you finished your journey and wrote the book?
Yeah, I mean, it was really spooky where we do this tour of the country. It was a year and a half of following Washington. And, you know, we didn't know what was coming. No one knew what was coming. And we finish up just under the wire, it turns out, and the pandemic hits. And then there is the death of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement and all this the social justice movement happening as I'm working on this book. And these issues were latent in the journey as we followed Washington, where their Confederate statues were being removed, all of this kind of thing. But as I'm working on this book, the country is going through a pandemic where suddenly all the travel we had taken for granted is gone. You know, we're all in our own little worlds, kind of fearful of others out there. I mean, it's kind of like a Stephen King novel. As I'm writing about a time that seems so distant in terms of Washington's journey and our journey, and yet all of the issues that were so latent within this journey are coming up and fresh. And the statues we had seen in Richmond of, on Monument Avenue were actually coming down. And so the writing process was, for me, something I've never experienced before, where, you know, history connects with where we are now. And I got this tremendous sense of a foreboding. Where is this headed? And so, I finished the book in September of 2020, just before the presidential election. And it was an experience like no other in terms of I've had in my career, where, you know, I've never felt history feel on such a precipice of where we are now. And it just struck home that, you know, what Washington was grappling with back then, whether it was the issue of slavery, whether it was the issue of how much power the federal government should have relative to the states, none of that's changed. It's just under a different guise, you know, it's just an evolution as we race into this unknown future. And so this made our own journey seem like one that had an urgency that we didn't even realize as we were in the midst of it.
And you grappled with his slave ownership. You grappled with the decisions he didn't make and cruelty.
Yes, and even before we headed out, I felt that this had to be a major focus of this book. It wasn't a major focus of his tour because he was trying to unite the country and knew that the issue of slavery would mean the immediate exit of the South if that should be pushed too far. And yet that meant, of course, that the issue was all the more important and all the more resonant with where the history would lead and where we are today. And so, you know, Washington, what impressed me by the end of this book was how far Washington had traveled, not just in around this country, but as a human being. I mean, this is a guy who became a slaveholder at age 11 when his father died, and he inherited some enslaved people. He grew up in this situation, and yet when he died, he freed his enslaved workers at Mount Vernon. That said, you can't let him off the hook. He may have been the only slaveholding founding father to do that, but it had waited till the end of his life. And in the final years of his life, he's actively pursuing Ona Judge, one of Martha's enslaved servants who had escaped to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and Washington was trying to get her back. And so Washington was conflicted. He was paradoxical. He could recognize that slavery was bad for the future of the Union, but he had a hard time rising above it himself, which is, you know, kind of goes with humanity, in which, you know, we can aspire to be better, but very few of us actually are as good as we want to be.
And that is Nathaniel Philbrick, historian and author of the new book, Travels with George, In Search of Washington and His Legacy. Thank you so much. What a treat to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you.
That's our show for today, folks. Thanks for listening. Tune in tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.